Well, I have a list of questions.
Mm-hmm.
You should tell stories as you see fit. Answer questions as thoroughly as you're comfortable answering. I'll poke and prod you a little.
Okay.
We'll go from there.
Yeah, we'll see what happens.
Michael's scarier than I am. I'm easy.
And at the end of an hour, I'll need to change the...
Flip the tape.
Tape,
sure.
Oh, but I have one today that I don't have to actually dismount, so...
Great.
Okay.
And we're running here too, Phyllis?
Yes.
Okay. Today is June 11th, 2008. I'm Laura Hill, here with Mr. Daryl Porter and Michael West of Binghamton University, and we are at City Hall, 33 Church Street. Mr. Porter, if we could start with a little bit of information about you. Where were you born? Are you a Rochester native?
Born in Rochester.
Okay.
Yeah, actually at Strom Moyer Hospital.
Okay.
At the time I was born, I was living on Sile Street.
Mm-hmm.
Which is now Freddie Thomas School. It's actually the front door of Freddie Thomas School is where my house used to be.
Interesting.
They tore it down to build a school.
Uh-huh. Are your parents also from Rochester?
No. My parents came to Rochester years ago, and I lost them when I was young.
Mm-hmm.
And both parents.
Where were they coming from?
Well, my father came from Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
By way of South Carolina, and then my mother came from Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. What were your earliest experiences as an activist?
Hmm. Oh boy. Well. Probably the earliest that I can think of was when I was working in the neighborhood with the Matadors to paint Bronson Avenue Playground. We painted Bronson Avenue Playground red, white, and blue, the big flag
mm-hmm.
of the United States. We did the whole fence around the playground that way.
Uh-huh.
And it was on Orleans Street, and we were given free paint jobs to senior citizens who couldn't paint their houses, you know. So if they wanted their front room painted, we went in there and painted for them.
Right.
All they had to do was buy the paint, and we did the work.
Tell me about the Matadors. I'm fascinated.
The Matadors started off as a club
mm-hmm.
Back then, and actually started off by accident.
Okay.
I actually was trying to join a gang at the time, which was the the Empress.
The Empress?
The Empress, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the Empress, and I was fascinated with the Empress, and I knew a lot of them.
Okay.
They were friends of mine, but at the time, in order, you couldn't just say, I want to join, you know, the gang, and they said, okay, you're in,
right.
You know, kind of thing. So they had two ways of getting in,
mm-hmm.
and they called it jumping in at the time. So it was either, you either went through the mill, which meant that everybody lined up like a tunnel, you know, one on one side, opposite
mm-hmm.
each other all the way down, and then you had to get from one end of it to the other end
mm-hmm.
while they beat you as you went through. And then you had to turn around and come back.
Right.
And come back to them, and they would beat you on the way back. Or you can take the version where as you can fight three members of the game, and if you beat all three of them, you got it.
This is a fist fight.
This is fist fight.
Did you get to pick the three members, or did they pick the three members?
No, they picked the three members, of course. You know. So I had decided I wanted to join, you know, at the time. So I decided I wanted to go through the mill. So I went through the mill. I got through the mill. And for whatever reason, warlord, who is the person who decides whether you go to war or not, you know, decided that that wasn't enough, you know, and that now I had to fight three different people to get in. So instead of being just one process, I had to do both processes. So I was a little, I was a creative in my way of getting through the mill, and they weren't too happy about it, even though there wasn't any rules against it. So they decided, well, we'll fix him, you know, we'll make sure he can't get around this one.
Sure.
And so they had me fight three people, and they picked three of the toughest people to fight at the time. And so I fought them, and I beat them. And so after I beat the last one, I'm like, well, I'm in now. And, well, of course, the warlord was one of them that I had to fight. And because I beat the warlord, they were upset because I wasn't supposed to do that. And they decided I wasn't getting in the club. Okay. Now, normally gangs don't rename, you know, on their process and things like that. They would say, okay, you either do it or you don't do it. But if you make it through, you know, they keep their word. You're a member. But at that time, they told me, no. And I said, you didn't make it through. You're not an emperor. You ain't good enough to be emperor. I don't know why I wasn't good enough to be emperor. So I was upset. Then I challenged the president because they have a rule. If anybody can challenge the president for the leadership. And if you win, you get the leadership. And if you lose, you get beat pretty bad. You know, there's no two ways about it.
Right.
But I was so mad, you know what I mean? I was sore and hurt.
But you were ready.
But
to
I
fight.
Was so mad. I just wanted to fight. You know what I mean? So
so all three fights took place at the same time. I mean, you fought, you beat one.
I beat one. And then you immediately fight the second one. They don't even give you 2 minutes or a round to rest up or anything. You know what I mean? You just had to get in. And they assumed you would never get through it because even if you could beat all of them on any given day, you couldn't beat them all the same day. Nobody expects you to do that, you know.
Right.
And so that's why everybody usually picks the mill. You know, because at least that way there, you either get through the mill or you don't, you know. So when I did win and they wouldn't honor it, then I wanted to challenge the president, which they should have honored.
The president was different from the warlord.
Well, yeah, no, the president is the head of the head of the game.
I see.
He's the head of the game. He's the one that picks who's going to be the warlord.
I see. Who's okay.
It's like the president, the vice president, secretary, you know, of state, that kind of thing.
So the warlord is like the minister of defense or something.
Yeah. And he's powerful. So it's a powerful person, you know what I mean? It's how, and the president, whoever that person is real close to the president. So they have a lot of influence on the president, whether you go to war or don't go to war, or that kind of thing. So I said, well, all right. So I challenged him, and he laughed at me, you know what I mean? He said, get at it. So there ain't going to be no fight, you know what I mean? Because, you know, you're all beat up and everything else. He said, he ain't going to sit here and take advantage of me. He wouldn't have been taking advantage of me, believe you me. The other three didn't take advantage of me, you know. So they left me there, you know. And I was steaming. And I was upset. And so when I left her, I had made up my mind, all right, since they won't let me in theirs, I'll start my own, you know. And that's what I did. That's how the Matadors got started, you know.
What was that process like, starting your own?
Well, actually, it was easy. It was easy because, first of all, I had a lot of relatives, you know what I mean, and stuff. I mean, we were the second largest family in the city of Rochester next to, Broomfields, you know. So, next to them, I mean, we were the largest, you know.
So you've got
cousins, we had all kinds of
siblings,
brothers and nephews, you know what I mean, and stuff that. And then friends, you know what I mean, and stuff. So basically what I did is they automatically became you know, members of the club. And sort of we decided what the name was going to be, and you know.
How did you choose the name?
You know, it's really weird because I've always been fascinated with bullfighters. You know what I mean? And not the fact that they're fighting bulls and all that, but just the outfit. I just love the outfit. And these bad capes, you know what I mean, and stuff. I mean, it was sharp looking. And I said, I like that, you know what I mean? So we had the Matador, and we wore the capes, you know. We had the Matador cape and the jackets and stuff. And then as we progressed, you know, we wound up with the jackets with the bull and the Matador and the whole nine yards and stuff. But that just stuck to me, you know. And I said that I would do that. Now, I never knew until later that when I almost got killed. Because people are very territorial about the names of their games or their clubs. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know, you know what I mean? And it just so happened that I was out on one Saturday and I got approached, you know, by some older men. You know, I'm saying, these guys are old, you know what I mean, and stuff, who wanted to hurt me. I said, what's the matter? They said, well, what you doing with that jacket on? I mean, what I'm doing with that jacket on? It's my jacket. The next thing that I know, you know, I was up in the air, hanging up with my feet dangling up on the wall at the place. You know, and all these people, all these grown men around me and stuff. And the guy started talking about, no, man. He said, you know, the name you got on that jacket, that ain't yours. And I didn't know what he was talking about. I said, what are you talking about? You know, is it the name of the jacket you had? What is it? I said, the Matador. He said, who told you could put Matadors on there? I said, who told me? Listen, are you crazy? And I'm thinking, all right, this guy lost his mind, you know. He's a grown man, you know, and I'm a young teenager and stuff. He wants to kill me over a name of a jacket. And it just so happens, my brother came in. And he walked in, and he seen him, and he hollered at me and told him to put me down. He said, you better put my brother down before I can kill you in here. He said, that's your brother? He said, yeah. He come to find out that was my brother's game.
I see.
Years ago, and they were the Matadors. And when they gave up, you know, grew up and everything else, you never disband. You're always a Matador. You know,
just grow up.
You just grow up, you know. Sure. You just don't run together like you used to and do all that stuff. But that was it. And he said, no, he says, you can't do that. He said, you gotta ask people permission. Can you use it? And that's the first time I knew that they were that, you know, particular about the name. Mm-hmm. So I asked him that night, was it all right to use it? And the guy told me, he said, yeah, any brother of Julius is a brother of mine. Mm-hmm. He said, you can use it. Mm-hmm. He said, but don't make us come back.
How old are you at that point?
Oh, I see. I started the Matadors at 14. Yeah, I was 14 years old when I started them.
So tell me a little bit about
But before you go on.
Sure.
So do you ever run into conflict with the emperors?
Oh, the emperors, no, actually, we actually became real close, like brother clubs and stuff. The emperors, if they needed us, we were there. We needed them, they were there. Because
for what purpose?
For any purpose. You know, I mean, if somebody was messing with the club and coming over in the side, because you got to remember now, being born on Sile Street in the Northeast, I was actually as a teenager raised up in the Southwest. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was on Adams Street, Tremont Street, you know, Troop Street. I mean, you name them, I just about covered every street over there, Jefferson Avenue, you know, the whole nine yards. And they were on from Plymouth Avenue.
Okay.
They were covered from Plymouth Avenue to Jefferson Avenue. Uh-huh. You know, and that was basically their territory. You know, and we were from Thurston back to Plymouth Avenue.
So who are they guarding against? Are they guarding against like white boys and gangs and so forth?
No, they were guarding against anybody that was coming into the neighborhood, you know what I mean, and disrupting the neighborhood. I say, for instance, somebody wanted to come in and jump on you, all right, and you were a part of us. Well, no, you didn't just come in here and jump on you. Mm-hmm. Our process was, if you had a problem with me, all right, you would go to the leader and say, look, you know what I mean, your homeboy did this to me, you know, and, you know, I'm here to make amends. So I'm calling him out, you know what I mean? So now you can bring your boys, I can bring my boy, but we're going to have a fair fight, you know what I mean? And you just, me and him. And what they'll do is say, okay, you guys may be at the playground and the whole place is surrounded and you start fighting. And the only rules there is that when somebody says they give up, you stop fighting.
And what did that signify, giving up?
Well, what it signified giving up is that you won at that time. You know, they're saying, okay, then you're the best. You're the best person today.
The best person doesn't or mean, the best game? Was,
no,
was
no. It had nothing to do with the game. It had to do with individuals.
Okay.
So if you beat, you know, George and George got beat, that was George, you know, that got beat. Wasn't the game. Now, when you get ready to beat the game, that's different. You know what I mean? That's what you try to avoid. You try to avoid game fights. You know what I mean? You may have fights among game members, but you don't want to have a game fight.
Why?
Well, because that's a bigger and a more dangerous thing. Game fight, there's no rules.
Okay.
All right? In the game fight, whatever way I can take you down, you're going down, period. You know what I mean? And there's no rules there.
So
but if we're one-on-one, the rule is you're not going to let me kill him if he said, you're the best, I quit.
Right.
All right? The fight's over. In a game, ain't no such thing.
So it sounds like your people generally wanted to avoid a game fight. This was not a good process.
That's what you want to do. You want to avoid the game fight at all costs because the game fight spreads out. It doesn't. It's like a shotgun. You know, it's like the difference between having a 45 and a shotgun. It's easier to have a 45 and hit one person, you know, whereas somebody got a shotgun trying to shoot at one person in the crowd and hit 10.
Sure.
You know, so.
Tell me a little bit more about the activities of the Matadors. You referred earlier to painting parks and homes. What was the service aspects of the group like?
Well, the service aspect of the group, we looked out for each other. I mean, that included school. When you were in school and stuff, people that normally would beat you upside your head or just jump on you or take your lunch money or all that kind of crazy stuff, if you were a Matador, they didn't do that. Because then they knew, you know, they were in trouble, you know what I mean? So they didn't bother with you. You had that kind of a prestige around there where they knew that you were a Matador, and they knew that if they messed with you, then they were going it wasn't just going to go away, you know what I mean, kind of thing. But if you were having problems with math or English or science or anything like that, whichever one of us was good at that, and I did a lot of the math stuff with my my members, and I had my cousin Eddie was good at English, and he would handle that. But we would sit down with you and help you with your math and help you with your science and try to get you through these things. We started up little quartets and groups singing and dancing. We had little parties and stuff like that. You know, things to kind of keep people out of trouble, you know what I mean? And you just more or less have basketball tournaments or games where you can get out there and play with each other. And we're there, we say, oh, well, let's go swimming, you know what I mean? It might be 20 of us go swimming, you know. But we kept each other busy and trying to keep each other out of trouble.
What, as a group, what was your relationship to adults?
Well, we were fortunate that we had a few adults that was out there in the community that night. We had, we did a lot of playing down there at Bronson Playground. And Miss Sydney was a young white lady short but powerful little white lady down at Bronson, whereas she can come out among all them giants and hard heads and loud mouths and everything else. Mm-hmm. And then she would say, look, you're making too much noise, be quiet, and they would shut right up, you know. And if somebody got in the hand and said, all right, go back in there and sit your behind down or something like that, it wouldn't take but 2 seconds. And she wouldn't have to say anything, you know. I mean, whoever was in there would tell me, you don't talk to Miss Sydney that way. Are you crazy? So you know who she is? Anybody going to leave, you going to leave. You know what I mean? And they were very, very protective, you know, of her, you know. People like Connie Mitchell, who, you know, was like my adopted mom, you know, and stuff, who got me out of a whole lot of stuff, and had respect in the community. So when she came down, we listened to her, you know, and did whatever she told us to do while she was there, at least, anyway. You know?
Right. Right.
But, you know, we have people like Jim Pratt, who was there with us and worked with us. I mean, these guys, Paul Bradshaw, they would come out in the middle of the night, you know, 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning and stuff. And somebody would call them and tell them, hey, there's getting ready to be a fight over at this party they got going on. You guys need to go over there and do something about it, you know. And they would show up and they say, hey, ain't you supposed to be home? You know, what are you doing out here? You know, so here he comes again. You know, we got, we'd be heading out. We're just leaving. Heading out of there, going. But I mean, there were people like that who we could call, you know, and I called a lot, you know. I did a lot of things I would never admit to any of my members, you know, back then. Because, I mean, even at a time when we did have to go fight, and we tried everything to, you know, to keep them fighting, but we had to wind up going anyway. There's been times where I have called them to let them know, you know, hey, we're supposed to meet up at this place, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, and this is what's going on. Well, they say, okay, as long as we know. So when you start coming down there, 2 o'clock in the morning, heading there, and all of a sudden you see all these police all over the place. And you say, well, you know, we got an excuse to turn around and go back.
I see.
Because the police are here.
I see.
Well, let's go. Let's go. Oh, man, it's time to do so. Here come the cops. You know what I mean? But you'd be just thinking, oh, thank God they called the police. You know what I mean?
So this is an interesting the roots of transmission for information are fascinating.
Yeah.
Fascinating. I mean, presumably somebody like Connie Mitchell or Mr. Pratt would have alerted the police.
They would have alerted the police to let them. They wouldn't tell them that you called them, but I mean, but they would let them and say, this is what's going to happen out there. You might want to have some visibility around that area, you know what I mean, and maybe be able to divert it. So now, if you know it's going to be 2 o'clock in the morning, don't show up at 10 after. You know what I mean? You get there early so that people can't get set up. Because once they get set up, you know.
Right. That's fascinating.
And we've been saved a couple times. I mean, there's been times we've been way outnumbered. You know what I mean? And stuff. And I mean, like 3 or 4 to 1, you know. And so, but my, you know, my man would go down, they didn't care, you know, how many you had or whatever it was. You would need them. Believe you me, you would need them because they had heart, you know, as, as big as you can think of, you know. And it was it, but I've always felt that if I can avoid any one of them getting hurt, I do what I had to do to keep them from getting hurt, you know, because they were my family, you know. They, I mean, you know, I loved them like I love my own brothers and sisters and stuff. And all I had to do was call them and they were there, you know. I mean, it was like, it was, I'd seen a picture of, what was it? I'm trying to remember. The movie I seen one day, because you don't realize how much power you have, you know, until you have to use it and stuff. But I remember one time we had a real serious problem. Actually, the whole city was up in an uproar. They finally put a curfew on the whole city because we had all the gangs were fighting and they were all partnering with each other, you know, and stuff. And they even called our our brother clubs from Buffalo and Syracuse and New York City, mm-hmm. and they had them coming down here to try to help out with the fight.
What year is this?
Oh God, this. We have that. I would have to go back and check.
Before it was in the 60s. After 64?
No, it was after 64.
After 64.
It was after 64, and we had the. They actually put a curfew on the city, and it got so bad out there you couldn't go to the store, you know, without worrying about getting shot at or, mm-hmm. you know, or getting caught mm-hmm. outside.
Getting shot at by.
By other members of gangs, you know.
I see. So the situation has taken a decidedly new turn now, because in previously you never fought with weapons, right?
No. You always had weapons. You always had weapons. You always, and that's why I said about the difference between a gang fight and members of gangs fighting. Mm-hmm. Members of gangs fighting, you can control to a fist fight. And then you go out, it's all, you get searched, nobody has a weapon, nobody can give anybody a weapon. Everybody around you has a weapon. Mm-hmm. All right? So that if you don't follow the rules and it breaks out, then everybody's prepared for a game fight.
Are we talking knives or guns?
You're talking both. You're talking knives, you're talking guns, you're talking about whatever, chains, you know, you're talking about ball-peen hammers. Hatchets, you know what I mean, machetes, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, those have always been part of the game, you know what I mean, and stuff. And for some games, they had anywhere from zip guns, you know what I mean, mm-hmm. to running around with 45s, you know, and stuff. And so it depend on the game that you were actually fighting with. Now, we were more, you know, fist fighting and knives and, you know, bats and that kind of stuff. Whereas Brother Club, like the Emperors or the Upsetters, and you know, were more guns. Mm-hmm. You know, because they were older and they could get the guns.
What causes it to escalate?
Well, this one got escalated because of they just. The situation happens where we had a member, one of our members, sister, was at a party. Mm-hmm. And one of the girls at the party, you know, got jealous of her because I guess her boyfriend or some guy she wanted to be her boyfriend mm-hmm. had an interest, you know, in him, in her. Mm-hmm. And they wound up fighting.
The two women.
Mm-hmm. All right. And one of my members' sister beat up the girl. And she beat up the girl. Well, when she beat up the girl, the boy mm-hmm. jumped on her.
Oh, okay. So that's a no-no.
You don't jump on a woman.
No, you don't do that. Mm-hmm. He jumped on her. When he jumped on her, and she ran home and told her brother, who was a member of my club at that time, he went down there, which he shouldn't have, because he should have called us. Mm-hmm. And we would have went down there and found out what was going on. But instead of calling us, the minute he seen how his sister was beat up and everything else, he took off and went down there to see the boy. When he got down there to see the boy, of course, his gang members were there already.
Right.
And they jumped on him, and I mean, they just stabbed him everywhere, on top of his head to the bottom of his feet. And by the time we found out about it, he was at the hospital, and they had all his intestines in a bag outside of his body, you know, and he was on a life support machine.
Mm-hmm. He died. He died.
No, he didn't die. I mean, I don't know. God was just with him that day, you know what I mean, and stuff. But he had several surgeries, and, you know, and stuff. But he was able to save his life. But I mean, he had to live with his intestines in the bag. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? He had, you know, urinating and everything else. Mm-hmm. You know, all in this. I mean, this is You know, all that was unnecessary. You know what I mean? I mean, because, I mean, one guy, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He got a whole houseful of his gang members that jumped him and all that. So when that happened, then, you know, I just declared war. You know what I mean? That's, you can't talk to anybody like that. You know, once you do that, you stepped over the line. There's no, you know, well, we can overlook it, so forget about it, you know, or just talk your way out of it or something. No, you know, you can't do that, you know. So this was one time that I actually declared war. We went out and we ran into some of his members down there, you know. And from that point on, their members have other clubs who are
brother
like
clubs.
Brother clubs mm-hmm. to them mm-hmm. that heard about what happened to them. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to retaliate. Mm-hmm. And when you start putting more, you know, two clubs together, now you got 1,000, then you got 2,000, mm-hmm. and you know, that then you call yours. You know, you start calling your, they come in, and we had the Outlaw Henchmen from New York City was the furthest one away that came down. They came down to join us, but what happened was, for some reason or another, we didn't call them this time and tell them ahead of time we'll warn them. But somebody decided that there were a lot of folks coming on the Thruway in the Rochester all of a sudden, and this thing is really getting way out of hand. Mm-hmm. And so what they did is they blocked off the Thruway.
The state police?
Yeah, the state police and the state troopers. They made sure that anybody that was a gang coming in, the Rochester, never got into the city of Rochester. They turned them around.
How did they identify them? Back. How did they identify them as a gang member?
I had no idea how they identified them as a gang member, you know, and I didn't know until later what happened, you know, that they actually had turned some of our people around and made them go back. Wouldn't let them into Rochester.
What were your channels of communication with people like Constance Mitchell at this point? Were the adults in the community, those that you've referred to, were they aware of what was happening? Were there interventions?
Well, they were aware of what was happening because they know who to contact when stuff like this happened. When they contacted me, you know, I told them what happened. Of course, they were saying, well, you know, let us try to do peace thing, we can talk. I said, no, you can't talk. You know, I got a guy laying up here. Mm-hmm. You know, his sister's hanging out, you know, in his body. You know, he's hanging out for his life. I got his sister looking like a man that's been in a fight, you know, mm-hmm. in Vietnam somewhere. And I said, you know, what do you want me to do? You know, if I go and tell them, oh, don't worry about it, you know what I mean? Well, just forget about it, this, that, and the other. You know, I'd be president that long. Mm-hmm. You know, they'd run me out of town. You know, I mean, because there's only so much you can do, you know.
Right.
So there comes a time when you just have to, you have to do what you got to do, you know. And that was one of the times. And it got bad because, like I said, you go out and you try to go to the store or something. Every car that you hear, you don't know if it's one of yours or one of theirs, you know.
Did anybody die as a result of...
Several people died because of that, you know, what happened there. So, I mean, that's what I was saying. This was some real serious stuff. I was staying with my sister at the time, and they burned her house down trying to get at me. Shot out. It's an old... It's an old trick that they do. Is what they do is they'll surround the house. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll come, knock on the door, and then somebody will throw a cocktail bomb into the house.
A Molotov cocktail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they set the house off. Mm-hmm. Now the front of the house is burning. So where do you go?
Out the back door.
There you go. And when you come out the back door, they shoot you. So because they know that's the only place you got to go. Well, me and my brother, Ricky, we were in the house at the time. My sister was working. We were in the house at the time, and it was just a good thing. I spotted him outside, And I told them, you know, I said, they're outside. We got to get out of here. And no sooner than I said, we got to get out of here, here comes the cocktail. Boom. Place goes up in flames. Get ready to run towards the back door. I said, no, don't go towards the back door, you know. Stay away from the back door. Jump out the side window. So we dived out the side window to the next neighbor's yard, rolled over, and kept getting up. And that's the only way we got away. If we had ran out of the back door, we wouldn't be here today. You know, because they would have gunned us down.
Right.
You know, and stuff. So, and it just got that bad, you know.
At this point in time, what is your understanding or your awareness of activism in Rochester? You mentioned Connie Mitchell is like a mother to you. You're obviously engaged in some fashion mm-hmm. with them. How did you understand the civil rights movement? How did you understand the things that were happening? Did that touch your
world? Well, I got involved in that. I mean, even the era of the fight era.
Mm-hmm.
I was involved with the fighterhood, actually, and I don't want to get into much of the fight era, because there are some moments, some embarrassing moments there mm-hmm. over leadership, you know, that
right.
happened, where it wasn't even safe, you know what I mean, to just
I understand
walk
that.
Around and show up when you got ready or whatever the case of it was. Well, we literally were, I used my name to protect Franklin Florence
mm-hmm.
because he had a lot of threats that were coming his way and everything else.
Sure.
And we showed up at the church and we would stand there and be around the church and everything else, watching people just to make sure that he was okay.
Is the protection from the white community? Is it from factions within the black community?
No, well, in this particular incident, it would have been against anybody, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because you had white folks who hated his guts, you know
mm-hmm.
what I mean? And then you had some black folks who were jealous of his prestige
right.
and his status, who thought that it should be them and not him leading
sure.
the charge, you know.
Let's back up a little. How does fight come into being? How does that process happen?
Well, that got started with Franklin Florence, Connie Mitchell, and them, Jim McCullers, and them, and Al Selinsky, who actually lived in New York City. And
Selinsky,
yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, we call him Al. I mean,
they call him Al?
Yeah.
I haven't heard that, okay.
Yeah, but it's Selinsky. But one of the things that they worked out with,
mm-hmm.
you know, and my oldest brother was involved with them at that because he was part of the Black Caucus that he had started, Emmett Porter, he started all that. So I, because of him, and a lot of this stuff I knew or was involved
mm-hmm.
in.
That's
Emmett Porter, my oldest brother, mm-hmm. you know. And so they had gotten started through that process, but once it started getting started and they started having meetings
mm-hmm.
and a lot of these conflicts started coming up,
mm-hmm.
we just started coming along, you know, we go to the meetings and we heard what was going on, we seen what was going on, and we decided we were going to watch out for them.
How did you form a loyalty for Florence?
Basically because of my brother Emmett,
mm-hmm.
you know, is why, you know, and what he was trying to do, you know, I believed in strongly, you know,
mm-hmm.
In what he was trying to do. And, I mean, we've been through that, we've been through the march of Martin Luther King, you know, and I was with him when he marched on Washington, D.C. They helped organize the buses that took us.
Right.
To Washington, D.C.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, I mean, we had a good
mm-hmm.
Connection. My brother was involved with Baden Street and ABC
yep.
and all of them. So I was there during the organization of that, you know what I mean?
Right.
A lot of that got me. Even PRYD and all of them came out of
mm-hmm.
Baden Street. You know?
PRYD is the Puerto Rican Youth Development?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So there was a lot of connection. Jim McCullough had a real strong connection with all the organizations and the group, and there were leadership back then that sat down and discussed the political issues of the day. I was on there. I was fortunate enough to be around, you know, some of them to be able to be in those meetings, you know, or know of those meetings or be around them, you
right.
know, to know what was going on.
Right.
You know.
There's been some, I've heard a number of stories about Franklin Florence, about him taking leadership of FIGHT. How would you characterize the relationship between Saul Alinsky and Franklin Florence, or Ed Chambers and Franklin Florence?
I don't, you know, I only met Alinsky, twice, I think, twice when he came to Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know a whole lot about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I knew about Franklin Florence, but I didn't know, about Alinsky that much,
mm-hmm.
other than the fact that they were helping work with him and organize FIGHT. Mm-hmm. Other than that, that's about all I knew about.
What was the perception in your circle of friends, your circle of people, about who was in charge of FIGHT, who was running that show?
Well, in my circles, Florence was running the show. I mean, that's.
Mm-hmm.
We were determined it was going to be Florence, not Alinsky or anybody else. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right, okay.
It was Florence, you know, and that's where the loyalty was with mm-hmm. Florence. It was locally, you know, not out of New York City, because
right.
we have to live here.
That's right.
You know, so we're not going to have anybody sitting in New York telling us how to live in Rochester
mm-hmm.
kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that was the thing. And then when we started talking leadership, we were talking about people that, who's been in the community, who's been doing things out in the community, didn't show up today and decide they want to be a leader.
Yeah.
But
who,
everybody knew who they were.
Who are those people? Who were the leaders in the community?
Well, we had several. Yeah, we had a lot of leaders in the community, independent on who you talk to.
Mm-hmm.
Would depend on what connection they had with those leaders and stuff like that. But
right.
We had black leaders, we had white leaders, we had Puerto Rican leaders, you know what I mean, and stuff that were out there, that people who could actually come into the neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
you know, or lived in the neighborhood. Connie Mitchell lived right there on Carissa Street, you
right.
know what I mean, and the house I was telling you about that got burned down
yep.
was on Carissa Street.
Yep.
So
mm-hmm.
Those people, you know, you can reach out and touch. So those people you sat down with at church, you know what I mean?
Right.
And, same pew, or those were the people that when you went into the store to get a soda
mm-hmm.
or something to eat, they were there getting it right with you. They were going to Stamps Cleaners, you know what I mean? And,
right.
I mean, they were there.
Mm-hmm.
So you knew them, you respected them, they knew you, which
right.
was even more important
mm-hmm.
because that way there, when I was out there doing something, somebody called me by my name and I look around. Then I knew I was in trouble, you know what I mean? There's one thing for somebody to say, hey, you stop doing that, because they don't know who you is.
But when they name names.
Yeah.
Right. I recall that from my childhood.
Okay. Yeah. You got to mm-hmm. be a little careful with this one. They know who you are.
Right. Right.
No. But that was always, it was a great thing to be able to know that you had an adult out there who actually cared about you. I mean, there was a guy named Paul Bradshaw. He reminded me of a big teddy bear, you know
mm-hmm.
what I mean, and stuff. I mean, but he was the nicest guy you ever had. He'd give the shirt off his back.
Mm-hmm.
He was always honest with you, and he always told you, I don't care what you did. If you're honest with me and you really are sincere, I'll do anything I can to help you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you got to be honest with me.
Right.
And that was, that's the way he was.
So as time moves on with FIGHT and the leadership starts to change, how does that affect you? How does that affect what's happening in the community?
Well, the leadership really didn't change that much. I mean, you had a couple of people in there,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then they moved out. Most people, if you ask them, they don't remember anybody but Florence.
Right.
Although Florence wasn't the only president, you know,
mm-hmm.
Of the organization, but that's who they would remember.
Right.
Because he was the one who was there the longest, you know what I mean? And
so you have in some succession Franklin Florence, DeLeon McEwen, Bernie Gifford, and Raymond Scott.
Yep.
Did you all develop the same kind of loyalty to those men that you did to Florence?
You know, our loyalty would have been the same to any one of those leaders as long as they went through that process and became the leader.
Did they?
And that's where the problem came in. The problem was who actually legitimately went through the process and became the leader as opposed to people who thought that they could just take the leadership, you know, and make themselves leaders in the organization. When you ran into that type of situation, that's why they didn't last long. Because if you're not accepted as a true leader, you know, just like today, we got a president and everybody don't accept as a true leader because they said he stole the election. You know what I mean? As long as they believe he stole the election,
right,
he'll never be their president.
Right.
You know.
So that controversial election then, of course, is between Florence and Bernie Gifford.
Yeah.
It's a very contentious process. Can you tell me a little bit about that convention night?
It was a nightmare on Elm Street.
Okay.
Is what it was. And like I said, I spent a lot of the time, you know, like I said, watching out for Florence, you know, trying to make sure that he got there safely and he got home safely, you know, kind of thing. I mean, we had people even attack the headquarters, you know, and try to burn up the headquarters down there. And It really was a nasty scene to have to go through. And it, for me, it probably was necessary that it happened, but it could actually destroy that community, you know. And it was about that close to getting out of hand.
From my understanding, there's physical altercations, there's gunshots fired.
Oh, yeah.
How was all that?
You know,
it's a,
now that I think about it now, I don't think the people who actually started the gunfire, they didn't finish it, but they started it, they actually started the gunfire, meant to hurt anybody or anything. I think they were more or less trying to show their muscle and scare people into voting their way and what have you, but then when they realized people were willing to die for what they believed in, they kind of backed off of that and decided this wasn't worth it.
Okay.
Because it wasn't, I mean, well, we used to call it then, you know, selling wolf tickets, you know. They said, you sell wolf tickets, we'll buy all the tickets you got. You know what I mean? The thing, and they sold us some wolf tickets and they got bought up and they decided it wasn't going to work here. So, and I think because of that, and them realizing how serious we were, you know, and how committed we were, and the fact that, you know, you may not be willing to die for him, but we're willing to die for him.
So the shots were fired at Florence.
Oh yeah.
Okay. So were shots returned?
Oh yeah. They were returned. You know, but they were returned.
Postage was due.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, that is, you know, it was a scary moment. And I don't care how many members I have with me or this, that, and the other. It makes no difference and all that. Anytime we get in any kind of confrontation like that where somebody can get hurt or killed, you know, I'm always nervous and I'm always worried.
Of course.
And, you know, my whole thing was, regardless of what happened, at the end of the day, he's going to get back home safe. And whatever you got to do, you know what I mean? So don't come looking for me to ask me, what do you want me to do now? You know what I mean? You protect this man at all costs.
So when the dust settles, it's accepted in some way, shape, or form that Gifford is going to take over the presidency. How would you characterize his time there?
Well, I'd rather not. I just, you know, like I said, I'd rather not.
Okay.
You know, it's, I just felt, like I said, it was a bad timing, bad moment, bad experience, and even today, I still can't figure out, you know,
so you
why they had to go through that. You know what I mean? Go through that. I mean, if, even today, if we had to do that today, go through that same kind of thing, it's just like it's like out of a movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you don't expect that. You know, and you said their leaders, all right, you go, you vote, you win, you lose. You go home or you stay there to help.
I mean, from my understanding, the voting process was very chaotic.
Well, it's going to be chaotic if you have a set of rules. Well, let me put it this way. With this new election here for the presidency, there was a set of rules that were put in place that everybody agreed to.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Then, when it was time to vote, all of a sudden, they wanted to change the rules.
Mm-hmm.
Florida and Michigan became a whole new ballgame. Now, how did you get those rules out of what we started with? And that's what happened over there.
Yeah, how does that happen?
They, the back room. It always comes out. When it doesn't favor you, then you try to muscle your way into getting the rules changed so they favor you.
Mm-hmm. So has Florence lost some favor in fight by that point?
I really don't think so. You know, I really don't think he did. I think what happened was, because, see, and that's the problem. The problem of it is that he hung in there long enough,
mm-hmm.
whereas the future remembers his name in connection with faith.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you go out here in the community and get in a plane and drop you off in any one of these sectors, and you can stop and you can ask the first 10 people, you know, give me a name of a leader of fight. And 10 out of 10 will tell you Lawrence.
Okay. So Gifford doesn't hang around long.
Nope.
I think his tenure is less than a year.
It is.
Why does he go?
Well, I heard a whole lot of stories about that, but then, you know, they stories. You know, I don't know for sure why he left.
What are some of the stories? What do people think? What are people's perceptions?
Well, the main one is that people's perception was that he got offered, you know, a job he couldn't turn down, making big bucks, and he left.
Mm-hmm.
So his loyalty to stay here or to make a big buck, he chose to make a big buck. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know.
Right.
You know, because I had never got a chance to talk to him about why he left.
Mm-hmm.
And
so then you have, it's Raymond Scott takes over.
Mm-hmm.
And he has quite a long tenure, 5 years or
yep.
so. What's that presidency like?
Well, it was a lot smoother getting in there.
It sounds like it was.
It was the normal process, you know, mm-hmm. that worked out, which made him more acceptable to everybody because he did go through the normal process without all the hoopla and
mm-hmm.
stuff on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
And people liked him. I mean, he had a close relationship with the ministers,
okay.
you know, which was any time you know, in the community, if you got a close relationship with the ministers, you know, you're halfway home.
Black ministers, white ministers?
Across the board. You
okay.
know, they respected him, you know, and they liked him,
mm-hmm.
you know. And actually, I don't even know where he went when he left here,
mm-hmm.
you know, or what he was doing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Any reason why, because I didn't hear anything about, you know, that.
But did he have
to I seen him years later when he came back, but I mean,
mm-hmm.
I never knew where he went.
Right.
What was the relationship between Franklin and Scott?
Franklin who?
And Scott.
And Scott?
While Scott was president.
I don't know. To tell you the truth, I really don't know. As I knew Scott and him and my brother, you know, My brother and them were good friends.
This is Emmett still?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They were good friends. My brother was good friends with, you know, with Floyd. So, as far as I know, they got along okay. But I couldn't tell you they didn't, you know, they did or didn't, for sure.
So what, I mean, in your recollections, what were some of the undertakings of Scott? What did he do?
By the time Scott got there, and I'm trying to remember if he was there with Wallace. Was Wallace still there? I can't remember if Wallace was still there under Scott or not.
Wallace is a first name or a last name?
Wallace is a first name.
What's his last name?
I can't think of his last name right now.
Okay.
But he was part of the the leadership structure for a fight. I'm trying to think. I think Scott was there when they were trying to put the fight on together.
Okay.
And once they got that formed, that was the organization actually that, what's his name? I'm trying to think of, I can see his face and I always forget his name. He's going to kill me too.
From?
He's actually running the, he has his own company now, the largest African American company in the city. That's part of fight. He came out of fight.
Mm-hmm.
And he came out of fight on. What is, I just had it. It took off of me again. Because his wife passed away some years ago. His name's going to come to me.
What kind of operation does he run?
My secretary, I know. Zero, remember. I'll get it because I can see him, but my brain when it gets locked like that. it'll be hard. But he ran the operation for Fight On.
Okay.
And then he wound up taking, they wound up selling the vineyard and all of that stuff. And then he took over the other part of the company and then he started hiring folks. And now he has the largest African American company in the city.
Mm-hmm. Now, DeLeon McEwen did it for a little while.
Yep.
And
for a little while. He did
backs
it.
Off
then he went
when
to the city school district.
Okay, mm-hmm. And so he sort of backs off when Bernie Gifford takes over the presidency. Is that accurate?
Yeah. And then he that's when he left and took the city school district job working for parents in Title I.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, actually he was working for Sam McCree.
Okay.
My pastor and founder of Zion Hill.
Mm-hmm. How does Fight come to its end?
That's a good question.
Why don't you think about it and we'll flip tapes?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Mr. Porter, is there a restroom close by here that I could run to quickly?
Let me show you.
I'd appreciate it. Oh, you can ask me about that name.
Yes,
Thank you.
that I was, at that time, it was hard for me to understand them selling fighters, you know. I mean, just.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little.
I don't know what to say about it. I never did understand it, because I knew what it was all set up for, and I knew it was supposed to help us, you know what I mean? It's not because at that time, you know, fighting Kodak and trying to get us jobs there, and get Xerox to open up their doors, Bosch Alarm and all of them, and everybody was hiring everybody else but us, you know what I mean, and stuff. So
when we
heard that we were going to have our own company and they would be able to hire us, and we didn't have to worry about being discriminated when we got to the door. I mean, it just was overwhelmed with joy, you know. And then when we found out they were selling the company, you know, it just said, wham, it was like a slap in the face, you know. So I don't know the politics around that, you know. I wasn't part of the discussions as to why or what they were going to do with the money or anything else.
Was that a closed door process, or were you just not engaged with fight at the time?
No, I've always been engaged with fight. I was engaged at that point, I guess, but I knew they were going to be selling it, you know, and all that. I just didn't know, you know, what the process was for coming to that conclusion. You know, and that part I was left out of, you know.
Did they offer an explanation? Did they?
They probably did. But you got to remember, now I'm young, you know what I mean? I'm in meetings I probably never should have been in to begin with, you know what I mean?
Right.
So when they were making these kind of choices, they were sitting down with the Jesse Jacksons of the world, so, you know what I mean, and stuff, and, Connie Mitchells and Jim McCullers and all of them. I mean, they're a lot older than I am, you know what I mean? They were in there saying, okay, then this is why we should do this, that, and the other, and then when they come out to tell the public what they're going to do, you know, yeah, then I can be a part of that, but I wasn't part of those.
Right, sure.
You know.
Did they announce the details of the sale?
They announced the details of the sale. Me personally, I didn't care. You know, I mean, the mere fact that they were selling was, you know, taboo for me as far as I was concerned, you know.
Yeah.
So I didn't really care what the details was. Because as far as I was concerned, it wasn't benefiting me.
Is that the general consensus of your people?
I don't know. I had a tendency at that time, if something like that, get on my, I just go on about my business, you know. I mean, it's just, you know, y'all, if you're happy, you know, stay happy. Just don't bother me, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And I just go ahead and move on, because I had, I believed in, you know, in the community, and I believe in opportunities. And I said, when we have the opportunities, we take advantage of them. And I believe in having more opportunities than less, you know. And at that time, to me, you know, you were letting me down if you let the company go, because the company was supposed to be for people like me.
So after it's sold, is it no longer for people like you?
Well, Fight On is not Fight On. Fight On is not for me, or it might not even be for you. I mean, it actually, for me, it was like, it had a funeral. It got buried. You know what I mean? And you remember the dead. You know, I mean, that's about as clear as I could put it, you know?
But the thing
that replaced it, that gave me hope back again, like I said, was Matt Augustine and Altrax. Because Altrax is under the same, set up for the same purpose.
Right.
You know, so although, you know, they hire everybody, but it mainly, you know, it's just there for you. They're not going to discriminate you if you come there with the skills that you need to get the job.
Right. No, I understand that. Altrex is still predominantly employs blacks and Puerto Ricans in Rochester.
Right, you know, and I mean, they kept the mission, and like I said, if you lose one and the other picks it up, you can feel better, but if you lose it altogether, you know.
Right. So does the sale of Fight On, does that lead to Fight's demise? Is that the end of Fight in this community?
I can't say in the community. I can say in me. Mm-hmm. It was the death of Fight. I mean, it meant, Fight no longer meant the same thing.
Okay.
I mean, what we had left, and the only two things we had left was Fight On, mm-hmm. and we had Fight Village. You know, so that was homes, you know, that were subsidized for,
right.
In our community, so we could have decent housing and stuff like that. So then that got transferred from over here to over there across town, mm-hmm. and stuff,
so
which is kind of strange too, but it became a different development over there.
Mm-hmm.
And once that development took place, you know, prices went up, you know what I mean? It displaced folks who were there earlier,
mm-hmm.
but couldn't afford to stay into the new mm-hmm. upgrades, you know, and then it's all, okay, then, well, we're building Fight Village over there across town, you know, put you in another section and start off, you know, again. And it was so a little disconnected somehow. It got disconnected.
Yeah. Does it disconnect from the people at that moment?
To me it did. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? To me it got disconnected. And then I think what happened is it got to a point where I guess Minister Florence, except Reverend Florence, I had to apologize because his name is Minister Florence.
Mm-hmm.
To remember that, you know. So
I do. Doesn't like a title, Reverend?
No. There's a distinct difference between ministers and reverends and Minister Florence, you know, a mm-hmm. description. So I respect that, and no disrespect by calling him Reverend, but mm-hmm. he's Minister Florence.
Mm-hmm.
And he's... when he decided that he was tired, you know, and he was going in other areas and stuff, things just kind of tapered down. I think a lot of it had to do with, a lot of things were done in a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at, you know, I mean, if you talk about the different issues that were going on at that time, the Fight went after. As they resolved them, they almost put themselves out of business.
Hmm.
So it got to the point where, you know, unless something comes up for us to do something, there's no need for us to have a meeting.
Unless there's a fight.
Something got to happen to say, okay, now let's get back to the table. How are we going to solve this problem? You know what I mean? But you say, oh, well, you know, your problem is you don't have a house today. You know, okay, then tomorrow you got a house.
Right.
Yours is you don't have a job, you know, then day after tomorrow you got a job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and now you're gone,
mm-hmm.
there's nobody left.
It's been said about Fight that one of their weaknesses was that they did not focus on education.
Hmm.
What's your perception of that?
I think they focus on education to a point. But I think their idea of focusing on education that the community never really grasped and picked up was not the educational system, quote unquote, like the school district.
Mm-hmm.
It was churches taking on the educational tasks. So you had more people doing homeschooling and more churches
mm-hmm.
having their own certified schools in their churches, and that's what they were trying to build up because they weren't getting the quality of education from the city school district that they felt that they should have.
Right.
And you're starting to see churches today starting to get into that now. They're still going back to what he was trying to do back then.
Meaning Minister Florence.
Minister Florence and Fight at that time. Is what some churches now are starting to pick up
mm-hmm.
and deal with, like the charter school situations
right.
and stuff, and saying, well, you know, kids got to be educated. I'm not going to keep sending them here and I don't feel they're going to get the education that they need, so I'm going to set up a charter school, you know, and teach it myself, or, you know, get a charter school down and teach it. Mm-hmm. And basically, that's where they're starting to move towards that way, and now you're finding school districts competing.
Right.
So to try to get those kids back, you know, and which means they got to get their grades up, their graduation rates up, and their dropout rates down.
Right.
You know, in order to do that. Right. But you're probably going to see more of that in the next 5-6 years, you know, mm-hmm. coming from, driven from churches. And we're not just talking black churches, we're talking Catholic churches that are the lead mm-hmm. on this thing now, you know, mm-hmm. and stuff. But you're starting to see it happen all over.
Okay. So, I mean, I don't think anybody would disagree that those large, tangible products of Fight On, Fight Village, Fight Square, the struggle with Kodak, are really sort of those big, headline-grabbing mm-hmm. Projects. When you start to move into the early 70s, a fight exists until somewhere around 77 or 78. Mm-hmm. What kind of structure do they have? What are they doing day to day? Are they still employing people? Do they still have an office staff? Are people still coming in to talk to them? What are they doing?
Well, they still had their office. You know, they still had their office. They still had people stopping by with their office. But I think the main thing was their main focus, mm-hmm. you know, which before, you know, was clear. And they were driven towards, you know, resolving those issues. And I think when those issues got resolved, they didn't pick up any other issues, you know what I mean, to focus on and to drive and to keep, mm-hmm. keep their community connected to that drive. Because they went from there to voter rep, you know, voter registration,
uh-huh.
Which they focused on, and basically that was what they were doing, you know, towards the end.
Okay.
You know, it was getting people signed up to vote. The problem was they got a lot of people to sign up to vote that never voted before. But when voting time came, they didn't have the organization to get those people to the polls so they could vote for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, that was the problem. I'll call you back. Let me turn this off. I'm trying to hit it off. Yeah, so, and then that was the problem that they have, and they never really got focused on doing that. And mm-hmm. because it didn't get focused on doing that, I think that's part of the disconnect between the community and
right.
what the fight was doing or trying to do.
So you have said that Raymond Scott was not exactly the kind of he was not a figure that garnished the same kind of remembrance that Franklin Florence does. At that point, what is Fight's relationship to the city of Rochester like, the city government?
Well, he had connection with the city government, and he was recognized as one of the leaders of of the black community.
Mm-hmm.
So people took him seriously, you know, when he came to sit out at the table. At least he could get in the room. You know, so he had that kind of prestige around him where he could do that. You know, the county officials of the world and go anywhere they wanted, you know,
mm-hmm.
and meet with the mayor, meet with the chief of police, and be respected for who they were and how important they were to the community.
Mm-hmm.
So he's had that, and he's basically a legend in the city. You know, I mean, you get to the legend status. You know.
It sounds like it's for very different reasons, though, than Minister Florence. Mm-hmm. Minister Florence demands that respect.
Mm-hmm.
He demands a place at the table. It sounds like what you're describing with some of these other people, Constance Mitchell, Raymond Scott, it's a different kind of process. How would you describe their process?
Well, you know, kindly make sure you were welcome to the table. You know, people were scared of Lawrence, mm-hmm. you know, one thing. You know, I mean, and for a good reason.
Well, the Matadors were protecting you know? Him, for starters.
But your Connie Mitchell's, you type of people. Like I said, you have your Martin Luther King's and your Malcolm X's, and you need them both. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And they all come in handy at one time or another. Mm-hmm. To get out there. She was more of the Malcolm X person. That would be accepted by the community as a leader that they would feel comfortable sitting in the room with mm-hmm. and not be intimidated, you know, and be able to get things done. Lawrence would be one that they know they have to sit in the room with, and they start off being intimidated, you know, mm-hmm. and stuff, but they know they have to come to some conclusion sure. To get it done. They both had their own styles. You know, meeting their goals, and they both would meet their goals. You know, just that he had his style, she had her style. You know.
Speaking of Malcolm, you mentioned Malcolm just now. Do you mm-hmm. remember Malcolm coming to
the Rochester? Yeah.
Have you gone over this?
We haven't yet. If we can mm-hmm. hang on for 1 second, did Mr. Scott's strategy cost? Fight something? Was something given up in that negotiation for fight?
I don't know. I personally, I think that, I mean, because now I'm older and hopefully wiser than I was, you know, believe nothing happens without a reason. You know, I mean, this stuff is all preordained and laid out. Certain things have to happen for certain things to come out of it and stuff. And I think it was meant for a fight to get to that point where they were going to be weaned off the community.
Okay.
And it's like passing the baton. Mm-hmm. You know, some people just don't know how to let it go. They lose the wreath because they drag you across the land with them. You know, and the other people realize, you know, unless they let it go, you're not going to win the race, you know.
Right.
And I think it was time for fight. And there's a strategy that fight used mm-hmm. That was right for that time, mm-hmm. you know. But as the years go by, you have to find different strategies, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. To be able to deliver and have the same impact and get the same results that you were looking for back in the 60s. So it came to a point where those strategies outgrew, mm-hmm. you know, the century they were in. And it was because of that, we're moving into a different era.
Right.
And you have to go at it a different way.
Right. Okay. So this is sort of moving back chronologically, but thematically, what was going on here with the black Muslims, with the police brutality cases, Rufus Farewell, A.C. White, and how did all of that, one, bring Malcolm X, and then what's happening in the community?
There was a whole lot of things going on back then. And there never, I don't even remember a time where there was a good relationship, you know, between the community and the police. No, I'm serious. I know there's been some good police and relationships with the community, and there was certain police officers that can go in there and they can walk through there with no gun and badge and stuff. I mean, people knew who they were, and they respected them, and they treated them whatever they wanted. And they were the type of people that, you know, you almost have to beg them to take them to jail. You know what I mean? And stuff, because they would talk to you and say, you don't need to do this. You know, give you a break, go on home, and forget about all that. But somebody else would come, lock you up, throw you in jail, and then ask you tomorrow morning, you know, what was going on. you know, kind of thing.
Right.
You know, so those people had high respect in the community, but as, quote unquote, an organization, mm-hmm. you know, they've always been distrustful, mm-hmm. you know, of the police, you know, and not trusting them or thinking that they're there for their best, you know, health,
right.
Kind of thing. So, and it was just, like I said, there were a few more bad apples back then than there are now, but they were bad apples, you know, and they gave the rest of the police a bad name or a black eye.
Mm-hmm. And so there's an incident with the black Muslims in January of 63. What happens surrounding that?
Well, I wasn't too involved in what happened, you know, because, no, first of all, I wasn't Muslim. Second of all, you know, I didn't know a lot of Muslims mm-hmm. back then. But I had heard, you know, what had happened. And like I said, in the first place, it was, they were community folks, you know, having a confrontation with the police. Well, there wasn't much needed, no, when it came to that, because the atmosphere was set up was mm-hmm. that they were right and the police were wrong.
So it's not perceived as black Muslims have a conflict with the police. It is community members are having a conflict,
With the police. And there's a difference.
Right.
You know, so when it came to that, then that's when you get involved. You know, and the other way around, it's a private beef that's happening, and that wasn't the way it was perceived.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So Malcolm X comes to Rochester. He comes a couple of times. What was that like? How were you aware of it or engaged with that?
Well, everybody was aware of it, you know, because they made sure everybody knew he was coming, you know, mm-hmm. that got there. And most people just wanted to be there so they could see him. You know, you heard a lot about him, but you never met him personally, so you get a chance to meet him. Well, you know, I got a chance to see him. I didn't get a chance to meet him, but mm-hmm. I got a chance to see him. You know, I know at the time that, you know, when you bring somebody like that to Rochester or anywhere, the security that they have around, you can't get close to people anyway.
Right.
So what the heck?
Malcolm had a lot of security.
Oh, they had security here for him. You know what I mean? I don't think he bought security with him.
Security for him or against him?
No, for him. Here in Rochester, they were looking out for him. You know, and I'm sitting there saying to myself, you can't get next to the guy. You know what I mean? Because I would have liked the guy to autograph, you know.
Sure.
Or something for them, but they wouldn't even let you get close to them.
Who's they? Is it city police?
They weren't city police. You know, okay. I think they were kind of protecting them from city police.
Okay, so he comes, when does Malcolm come to?
He comes twice in 62.
Yeah,
62. Okay.
And then 65 is probably the time you're referring to?
Yep.
65. Because by which point then he has broken with the Nation of Islam.
Yep.
So it's his own security.
He has his own security. He has his security, but you got to remember that we have security here too.
What kind of security?
There was security with fight. There were security people there.
Oh, I see.
So were you part of fight security?
I was part of there, but I couldn't get close to him because his security wouldn't let you know where he was.
I see.
If you weren't part of their immediate group, you didn't get nowhere near.
Mm-hmm.
Are we talking approximately lots of people, dozens?
Oh, they probably had a lot more than you saw or thought you saw.
Mm-hmm.
There was they were very, very overly protected.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost as bad as when the Muslim leader, which color came here?
Farrakhan.
Oh my God! And they were using our school, and I was the principal. And they almost didn't let me in the building. We were over at Freddie Thomas. I'm sitting there saying, are you crazy? You know, it wasn't for me. You wouldn't even be in here, you know. And so,
right.
And then he just happened to come along, you know, one of his members just said, oh, that's Mr. Porter. Man, what are you doing? Leave him alone. You know, he can come on in here. He's the one letting us use it. I said, well, crying out loud. You know.
Hmm.
But it was one of those non-memorable things.
So you remember his speech, you heard his speech. How did it strike you?
Well, to tell you the truth, I was so upset about the security and the way, you know, they were treating me. I didn't pay much attention to what he was saying. You know what I mean? It just, it was, and I believe there were probably quite a few of us who were there were more upset about the way we were treated, you know. I mean, to us, we felt, you know, we're not harmed to him or anything else, you know what I mean? We're here and we ought to be able to see him, say hello, get an autograph or something or whatever, or even if you can't, there's a certain way to tell people, you know what I mean?
Sure.
That, I mean, all this, you know, pushing and see, I don't let nobody push me, you know. You're out there pushing a lot of lose your arm, you know what I mean, and stuff. And I mean, these people don't know me, they don't know you, and stuff, but they treat me like, you know, you ain't nothing, you know what I mean, get out of the way, you know what I mean.
Right.
So what in the world is going on here, you know? And I got to the point I almost left, you know, that's how upset I was when I was there.
How did you understand the purpose for his visit?
Well, I tell you the truth, we knew that he was coming. That's all you heard, that he was coming. But nobody had actually said why he was coming. Mm-hmm.
Did you know who brought him, who invited him?
No, I assumed it was a fight. Mm-hmm. That's what I thought. I didn't know. I didn't, either they brought him over here or the Muslims brought him, somebody brought him, you know.
Right.
And but who knows? They may not have bought him at all. They might have read about it in the paper and just came.
Right.
You know.
Who were the kinds of people that had access to Malcolm while he was in town?
Well, that would have been Florence and them. You know, Connie Mitchell. They would have been in the Jim McCullough. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, and stuff. I know my brother met with him. You know, because he was part of it. Their inner circle stuff about, and you know, the Muslims, of course, you know, but they would have had it. They would have had it.
Is your brother still here in Rochester?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But other than that, you know, I don't know. I don't think he had any contact with the police at all. I think they did all the security for him, and more or less, because I know White didn't want the police anywhere around there because they were worried about what the police might do.
Sure.
As opposed to anybody else, you know what I mean, and stuff.
Sure.
That was it. Mm-hmm.
Discussed the Jelinski.
We did a little. They called him Al. Yeah.
Okay.
We talked a little. Yeah. So, if we can sort of leave the movement stuff behind a little, how did you come to be involved with city government? How does a matador come to be involved in city government?
Well, I guess it all started with Connie. You know, Connie at the time, when she decided to run for office, and then she needed help with people dropping off literature flyers and all that kind of stuff like that, and I just had my people just go and drop stuff off for her. And we got involved in her campaign, and through her campaign we started getting involved in other campaigns and stuff. And
Which campaign for her, Mr. Porter?
She was the, what's the proper, because they don't have that title anymore. She was the supervisor.
The ward supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
So that would have been early 60s.
Third ward supervisor.
Yeah.
Yeah, back in the early 60s. And actually got a little video clip of her when she was running. And she, you know, to be involved in that race at the time, I didn't know she was the first black female, you know, the whole office, you know, stuff. So all I knew was that she wanted the job. Anything we could do, we'll help her get it, you know, that kind of thing. But starting off with that and getting involved in the community, the YMCA had a program going back to how they stopped all the gang fighting back then, what I was telling you about, and stuff. They came out with this YMCA outreach program.
Okay.
And where they were smart enough to hire gang leaders, you know, to work with gangs to stop fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Which that's how I got my first real job at the city, mm-hmm. you know, was as a member of the YMCA outreach program. And so what we did is we worked and sat down and built a truce with all the gangs and got them to sign off on it and then stopped the fighting. And that worked. After that worked, and everything went back to normal, then they laid all of us off. I said, start a fight every now and then, you know what I mean? Keep my job, man. You know. So kind of, but it was the best program that they had, you know, and it just, if they'd have kept it going, you probably wouldn't have all these fights you got going on now, you know, mm-hmm. and stuff. But they, you know, as soon as something works and they eliminate the problem right then and there, they think they can just drop it. It's not going to come back, you know,
right.
and stuff. But it was a great program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I learned a lot out of that. Learned a lot of the responsibilities. You know, a lot of responsibility with the game, believe it or not. But
seems like there's a very organized superstructure.
Oh
there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and but to have a job like that and then having to go sit out with game leaders, you know what I mean. And then try to explain to them why they should shoot and kill each other. and you were one of them.
mm-hmm.
You know, it took a little finesse to get around. But it worked out okay. And then we got some of them jobs, you know, which was great. Because the city packed it up, you know. And they said, well, you know, we got these X amount of positions and stuff. And if you really got some out there that, you know, you think, you know, fit these jobs, you let us know and, you know, we'll put them to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so we recommended some guys and they hired them, you know. It worked out okay.
Mm-hmm.
If I knew my job was only going to last a short period of time, I took one of them jobs myself.
Sure.
I tell you. But
so what do you do after the Y project?
Well, after the Y project, I had my main job was a shoe shine boy. I shined shoes. Actually, when I got married in '65, I bought my rings, paid for the wedding, and my down payment on the house I rented, mm-hmm. you know, on Jefferson Avenue, all that for shining shoes.
Where did you do this?
Well, I covered the whole city. I shined shoes from West Main Street all the way to Ridge Road.
Mm-hmm.
I stopped at Ridge Road and Dewey.
Okay.
And then I turned around and came all the way back and came down Lake Avenue, all the way down Lake Avenue, covered Main Street, all the way back to West Main Street. Mm-hmm. And then from West Main Street, I finished up and went home.
So the city hires you to do this, or the Y hires you to do this project. How old are you when you're doing that work?
What was that, 16, 17? For the Y, I think it was 17.
So you start the Matadors at 14. 3 years later, you're working to end the gang issue in Rochester.
Yeah.
So then you go on to Shining Shoes. And you do that for how long?
No, I was shining shoes at 14. I've been shining shoes since,
mm-hmm.
well, I started shining shoes at 7. Yeah, with my mm-hmm. brother, Ricky. You know, and I used to be on his route. Mm-hmm. And go with him.
So while you were in the gang, you're still shining shoes?
Oh, yeah.
So is that your main source of income?
That was it. Nobody else give me no money. That was it. Outside of 50 cent I used to get to go to the movie on Sunday,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the money I got from church.
Yeah, but does gang have a source of income? Do the Matadors have a source of income?
Not the Matadors. The Matadors, the gang or the club itself, you know, no, doesn't have its own source of, you know, of income. It was individual people either had money or they didn't have money or something. Mm-hmm. somebody gave money, they didn't give money, they weren't. Mm-hmm. You know, but there wasn't, it wasn't organized where we went out and robbed people so that we can have mm-hmm. X amount of money in an account, you know, stole cars or mm-hmm. stuff like that, you know. There's there were some gangs out there who did that, but I mean, but it wasn't us.
There's mm-hmm. no dues, there's none of nah. that kind of.
No, you paid your dues when you got in there. Now, the ones that got in there freak, you know, in the beginning, mm-hmm. all right, but our group was the same as the emperors were, only we honored it.
You modeled their structure.
We modeled their structure, mm-hmm. but we honored the structure as well, you know.
Right.
So that, and you become a principal at what point, and how does that work? How do you become a principal?
Become a what?
A principal. You said you became a...
At Freddie Thomas.
At Freddie Thomas?
Mm-hmm.
No, I just said I became a principal. You know, I said when you become the president of the organization, you know what I mean? It's just like with the games and stuff. If you're the president, you know, you control everything to a certain extent.
No, a while ago you said Farrakhan came to talk and they locked you out of the school.
Freddie Thomas. Well, they tried to lock me out of the school.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, but at this point you are the principal of that school, yes?
No. I was the president of the school board.
Oh, you're president of the school board.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was the president of the school board. The principal of the school wasn't even there. You know what I mean?
Okay. Yeah, so but how do you become president of the school board? I mean, it's a pretty high position.
Well, you get elected. About the city of Rochester.
Oh, it's an elected position.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and the board, to get to the board is an elected position.
Right.
To get to the presidency, then you have to be elected by the majority of your members.
I see, okay.
So there's seven board members, so you got to have five out of those seven who want you to be president.
So we're missing some time, though. Your shining shoes till when? Are you still shining shoes?
I'm shining my own shoes. Yeah, but when I stopped shining shoes, I probably was 23 years old, mm-hmm. 24 years old when I stopped shining shoes.
And then what did you do?
You know, I worked for, illegally, mm-hmm. but I worked for John Abrams Bar,
uh-huh.
Which was right here on West Main Street, next to the old Jack Slopton building. It's right across the street from it. And I had, I went there. That building there used to be the old manpower training.
Okay.
And I was doing manpower training there, getting my auto mechanic and diesel mechanic certification
mm-hmm.
and stuff. But then I'd go over there and fill up their chests with the beer. In the coolers,
mm-hmm.
and when they stuff comes in, I just fill up the coolers and everything, and then I shine some shoes, and I start shining on my shoe shining route. Mm-hmm. So that was my first job outside of the one I had with the city and the shoe shining.
Mm-hmm.
And then I
what's illegal about what you're doing though? You said you work for them illegally. You mean off the books or?
Well, yeah, because I wasn't old enough to be in there. I wasn't supposed to be in there.
I got you. So they paid you under the table.
So they paid me under the table.
Okay.
You know, and I took care of the stuff for them and then I got out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that. But my first real legit job that paid the big money was with Dorsha Buick.
Okay.
You know, and they... not Dorsha, but Lou Oak's Bureau. They used to be right here on Genesee Street. Right? And so I started working there, and I got that job. Actually, I got the job, but I shouldn't have got the job because I knew how to do mechanic work.
Okay.
And stuff like that. So I wasn't no problem. I could work on trucks and cars and whatever they wanted me to work on. One of the problem was is that they you have to go out and test drive, you know, like if you do a set of brakes or something like that, you
right.
have to go test drive and everything else. Well, they had a truck too that you had to take and go pick up equipment and stuff and bring it back. And the last question they asked me before they hired me was, can you drive a stick? Why in the they never drew a stick. But here I am, you know, I can get a job, at least for a day. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know? But if I get the right answer now, if I get the wrong answer, I ain't gonna get no job.
Right.
So I said, well, I told him, yeah, I can drive a stick. You know? So he said, well, okay, fine. He said, drive a stick, you're hired. So he told me to come back the next day and I was gonna, what I was gonna be doing and this, that, and the other. So I'm in there working, minding my own business, you know, and I just put on a set of brake service on this Buick. So then he tells me, he says, I want you to go and pick up some brakes. I said, pick up some brakes? I said, okay. Because it didn't dawn on me. I thought he was saying, go on. I'm thinking, I go get the truck and go take off. I get out there in the truck, and I look down.
It's a stick.
I said, what in the world? I said, oh, shoot. So I'm looking around. I want to make sure the guy ain't nowhere around me.
Mm-hmm.
I look around and I start the thing up. And he was standing there by the door and he turned around and went back inside. Because after he showed me where it was, he waited. I got in there and I watched him and he went inside. It's okay. I started up and I'm moving this stick and the stupid thing keep going toward it. And I got to back it up because I'm. He drove into the slot, right? And I'm about this far up on the wall. And I'm jerking up, and I'm getting up on this wall, right now. And oh man, I'm trying to get, I got about that far from the wall, and I finally got it in reverse.
Uh-huh.
And it backs up, you know, I said, oh shoot. And then I just chuckled up, finally got it go forward, and I got it in first gear, never took it out of first gear. And I said, that's it, it's in first gear. And I'm in the driveway, you know, so you can't speed anyway. So
right.
For me to be going slow in the driveway makes sense. So I just took my time, easing, creeping along,
mm-hmm.
Got out there onto the street, turned the corner. I was trying to get away from that stupid big old glass window where you can sit there and look. And I said, oh God, please let me get past this building. Somebody come out there and see me. And I thought, but I got there. By the time I came back,
you knew how to drive a stick.
I was doing it. I was feeling so good because I knew that I could drive it. Never dawned on me how long I've been gone. And I said, what happened to you? You know how long you've been gone? I said, oh, I'm sorry. I wasn't going to tell him I was out there trying to work.
Right.
You know, but I got it.
Right.
And I would have still been there until they decided to move out in Henrietta.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, anybody wants to move in Henrietta, you know, still got a job. And if you don't, then, you know, hey. Nothing we could do about it, but we're going to be moving, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. I had no way to get out there, so I had to let them go.
Right.
So that was my short span.
And suddenly you went into politics.
Well, no, I didn't. No,
from being a Catholic.
I didn't go into politics right away. I helped out with different campaigns, being part of politics and all that. But I didn't start politics until 1993. Hmm. 1993, I ran for the school board. Well, actually, I didn't run at that particular time. There was an opening on the school board because we had one of the school board members who decided to run for city council. Mm-hmm. One city council, so it left the spot open. Mm-hmm. So when you got a spot like that open up, what they do is they'll fill the spot.
Mm-hmm.
And they had like 30 days to fill the spot.
Who was responsible for filling it? The board?
Well, the board has 30 days to fill the slot. And if they don't fill it in 30 days, then the president of the board can pick who they want.
Mm-hmm.
to put in there. So that puts pressure on the rest of them to at least try. You know,
right.
So what happened was, being down to six members, I wondered if I had five members of the board who had promised to submit my name and vote for me. Mm-hmm. So it was five out of six. I get out, and by the time they get ready to vote, it turns out 3-3. Because somebody went and told a lie that somebody bleed. Mm-hmm. And when they bleed it, they turn around and say, well, no, I'm not voting for him. Mm-hmm. You know, and then they talk to their colleagues that, and they say, oh, okay, then you ain't voting, we ain't voting, you know. So it wound up being a 3-3 split. And it was funny because it came down on three women and three men. And the guy that left was the man that left out of the position, mm-hmm. all right? And I said, well, wait. And I said, what the heck, what happened? I thought, you know, well, no, well, we changed our mind.
You know what you said,
what you did. Nobody would tell me what I said or what I did, or supposedly said it did. Mm-hmm. I didn't find out until later mm-hmm. what it was, and then they came back and apologized, but it was too late then because they had already screwed me out of the seat. Mm-hmm. So they said, well, it's a 3-3 tie, so we have to look for an alternative candidate. And because otherwise, you don't have a president, so you have nobody to break the tie.
I see.
All right? Mm-hmm. And so you're voting, whoever this seventh person is going to be, is going to help you vote for a president.
Mm-hmm.
So they sit down and say, well, okay then, if nothing happens, then you have to wait till election time and then just have an election.
Right.
So they came up with a name. And it was they gave a lot of credit. It was a smart maneuver on their part, but they brought this person in that they were as an alternate candidate. And they said, okay, well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you the fourth vote. Because whoever gets the fourth vote actually controls the agenda of the board. So I'll give you the fourth vote if you give me my candidate for presidency. They said, oh, okay, all right. So actually, you can have the presidency, and you're going to give me mm-hmm. my fourth vote. Well, what good is it having the presidency if you don't control anything? Hmm. You know? So the point of it is that you get to be the president. You're the one supposed to have the power and authority to do things.
Right.
But if I control the board, I don't care who the president is. So they wound up getting the person that they wanted.
Okay.
They gave the person who wanted to be the presidency. Mm-hmm. And they got the fourth vote. And the funny thing about it is the person who was president, the person they gave the fourth vote to, who thought that he actually wound up with the fourth vote because it was a woman, and nobody knew that was his cousin. So they figured, well, we'll outsmart them. They'll think they got the fourth vote. I get the presidency, and then my cousin will be voting with us. And what happened was the cousin voted with them.
Oh, that
was a double whammy. Oh, that was beautiful. I had it. I loved it. I was upset. And then after that, you know, this worked out great, you know. Mm-hmm. So
then do you actually run yourself?
I ran in 2004.
Uh-huh.
I ran and I led the ticket. And I got on the board. And every time I ran, I led the ticket, mm-hmm. you know, and got back reelected back to the board again.
So are you currently a board member?
Am I what?
Are you currently a member of the?
But you can't be. No. I ran and won, and the last time in 2006, but then the mayor came and offered me this position, and then I had to leave. Mm-hmm. And the same thing, mm-hmm. like a vacancy. Mm-hmm. I happen to be the president.
Uh-huh.
Same situation I walked into, the same one I was coming out of.
Right.
The only difference is I stayed there to make sure that they got a president, you know, in place in the seventh vote.
Do you run for the school board as part of a political party?
Democrats. Yeah, registered Democrats.
So. Okay, so that is actually how that, what's the partisan kind of process?
Well, no, it's a partisan process because anybody can run for the school board. But the last time the school board was nonpartisan, I think it was 78 or something.
So you ran for school board as a Democrat.
Right.
And you had, it sounds like, nurtured relationships with other Democrats by working on their campaigns throughout the years?
Yeah, everybody on that board at the time that I ran, I had worked on their campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, you know, that was on it. That's one of the reasons why I got 5 out of 6 votes.
Right.
I should have got 6 out of 6. But, yeah, it can't be perfect all the time.
Any follow-ups? Last questions?
No.
Thank you so much, Mr. Porter. This has been a very pleasant afternoon.
It's a fascinating story, indeed.
It is.
Yeah, it's you know, the thing of it is the more we talk about it, I was thinking about it, is my history with the school district, it was really a blessing because the same school district that rejected me and suspended me from all the schools in the city of Rochester is the one I wound up being in control of.
Isn't that interesting?
Which was really, ironic that wound up being the situation. And I had to go and get a high school equivalency from Urban League, you know what I mean?
Right.
In order for me to get my diploma.
It's funny, Mr. Porter, when we were looking through some of the documents in the city archives, I came across your name, and I thought, how does this happen? He's a matador, he's engaged in this uprising, he's not even quiet about his engagement. I mean, you had done some interviews, there was, you know, plenty of stuff that you had to say about it. How does he get to be part of the mayor's office? And Michael joked, riots work.
Yeah, believe me, I tell you, we come a long way, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And it's I take all of it as a blessing because I got a lot of young people today that come to me and said, you know, if you can get there, you know, we can get there.
Sure.
And tell them, I said, you can do whatever you want to do, but you got to remember, you know, what you do at 10, 12, 14 years old, will haunt you when you get to be my age. And I said, so you have to be careful with the choices that you make.
Yes,
you know, I'm just fortunate enough that I didn't make the choices that would have kept me from being here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And blocked me from getting in the door.
Well, thank you so much.
I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
This is fantastic. I didn't want to keep you past the 3 o'clock hour. I promised we'd be done at that point. And thank you again for the LTREX information.
Oh, yeah.
I'll try to get a hold of Mr. Augustine. I'd like to talk with him.
I'm sure he'd be more than happy to talk to you. Give you a little perspective on